All statements, views, and opinions are personal and do not represent the United States government, the Department of Defense, or the United States Army. Welcome to the Center for Army Lessons Learned podcast, Insights from the Fight, the podcast dedicated to bringing you lessons learned from exercises, warfighters, and Army fielded forces. I'm your host, Mr. Jeremy Sturmer. Today, we're discussing operations with some members of the Combined Arms Support Command, CASCOM, Mr. Stacy Lee and Mr. James Swenson. Gentlemen, thank you for both being here today as we discuss some of the challenges and tools available to units when planning and executing deployments. To start, could you each share a brief overview of your background and experience with deployment operations?
Well, first off, Jerry, thanks for having us. You know, this is a topic that we're passionate about. James and I both, as we go through, we're both retired military. We both spend quite a bit of time doing deployment and transportation. For me, personally, I started in the Army back in 1990 as a combat engineer. Ended my career, uniform career, in 2015 as a lieutenant colonel, logistician planner. I've worked logistics plans and deployment literally from the company level all the way up to the four-star deployed level. I was hired as I was coming out of uniform in the Deployment Process Modernization Office, which is unique to the Army because it's the only organization in the Army that focuses solely on deployment, end-to-end. Other organizations focus on pieces of it. We focus on the deployment process overall. So our, you know, water cooler conversations are about deployment. Our meetings are about deployment. We're excited to actually come on and talk about what we do and how we can help the Army increase their strategic readiness. So I am married. My wife is also retired military. She retired a year after me. I have a daughter who is a teacher down in the Virginia Beach area, and we have two goofy rescue pups and a cat that adopted us, so I'll turn it over to James.
Hey, James Swenson here. Like Stacy Lee just said, I'm with the Deployment Process Modernization Office. I'm the Analysis Branch Chief. So I've been here since 2018. Prior to that, I was active duty Army. So I was a transporter all the way through for about 26 years. So I did deployments from the operational, tactical, and strategic levels, work in all aspects of deployment. You know, like Stacy just mentioned, you know, we're happy to talk deployment with this community and just kind of educate the force on what we're seeing real time. As we get out and do our site visits, we have a tremendous amount of lessons learned and tips, and we're definitely looking towards the future. We are closely nested with the Army G3 on all things Army force projection. So we lead several efforts in that arena. So we can definitely share some of those things today as we discuss with you.
Thank you for those introductions, gentlemen. In March of 2025, CAL, in collaboration with the Deployment Process Modernization Office, DPMO of CASCOM, produced the Deployment Handbook. This covered planning, pre-deployment activities, portions of RSOI including reception, staging, and onward movement, and it also covered redeployment. Can you explain the motivation behind this handbook, how it was developed, and how it supports Army units preparing and executing deployments?
So jumping back in history a little bit, in 2015, we published the CAL handbook on the Command Deployment Discipline Program. It was a great little typical CAL manual size, so it would fit in your side pocket. It had checklists for units all the way from company up to division, installation, that talked about all the key steps to deployment. Well, Kirk Foster and the CAL team hit me up about either updating that or letting it just go obsolete. As we sat down and thought through it, saw there was an opportunity to actually expand beyond just, you know, one piece of the deployment process. That was kind of the genesis of what we put together in conjunction with CAL. And this is kind of exciting because when we published that, it covers literally end-to-end tips, tricks. It's got the key players, kind of what their roles are. It talks lessons learned. We've got some really great updated checklists and the annexes. But as you know, as soon as we publish something, it goes static. Well, what we did was we tied the CAL handbook for deployment to the Army's deployer's toolbox. So anything that you see as far as a checklist or lesson learned or form or whatever, if you see it in that static handbook, you can actually go to the deployer's toolbox and you can download the latest version of it in an editable format. None of it is proprietary. None of it is classified until you fill in, obviously, your information. But what we wanted to do was, instead of having, you know, some NCO or officer or somebody try to recreate a checklist, just go to the toolbox, download it, throw your unit's logo on it, make it specific to your location, and call it good. The only thing we here at DPMO get out of it is we put tools out to help the field do what they need to do. And I'll tell you, a lot of the tools that are resident now on the toolbox and in the handbook itself actually came from the field. We are collectors. We always look for, you know, if somebody's got some sort of checklist or some sort of tool that will help, you know, track deployment or prepare for deployment, we always invite them to send it to us. We'd like to post it and get it out so that the whole Army can use it. So that's history and kind of the genesis behind the handbook.
If you were to talk to commanders, what are the critical actions that a unit could take when we look at that planning and preparing, even before you're notified of a deployment activity, that they can do in order to make sure that their unit is ready to be deployed?
So I'll hit that real quick, and then I'll turn it over to James. I will tell you, the very first thing is make deployment planning, pre-deployment planning activities, and the like part of the day-to-day battle rhythm. You know, one of the things that we were really good at in the 90s but got out of when we were doing, you know, just the patch chart rotations to Iraq, Afghanistan, that became just basically a spreadsheet drill. It didn't take a whole lot of planning for a commander to pull down whatever their required equipment lists were and what their timelines were, that, which they knew, by the way, 12 to 18 months out. So we got out of the habit of really putting the rigor on the operations side into deployment planning, the activities that go into it, and really just making it part of what we do every day. One of the most critical things a commander can do, regardless of unit type, is take your metal task number one, which is deployment, and get serious about it. You know, use the tools that are out there. We mentioned the Command Deployment Discipline Program. That is a tool that is the sister tool to the Command Supply and Command Maintenance Discipline Programs, but they are checklists literally for a commander to be able to lay out what the tasks are that they need to do to get better prepared. And they're solely for the commander. You know, there's an exercise program that goes into it. And hey, if you knock it out of the park, we even have the Deployment Excellence Award, so you can actually get recognized for it.
Just to amplify some of the comments Stacy made, you know, commanders must take ownership of their deployment and no longer treat it as they're just a customer of deployment, which we have seen over the OEF, OEF, OIF rotations. What I mean by that is they must empower their people to drive the process. We are starting to see that throughout the force. You know, units that treat deployment as an operation, where the battalion, brigade, S3s drive the operation or drive the deployment, those units tend to fare a lot better than units where it's just left as a task for logisticians. That brings the rigor that Stacy just mentioned into the process. It holds units accountable, and it really helps speed up the deployment process. As we move forward in this future fight, future conflict, it'll be about the speed and accuracy of deployment, and that's critical throughout every phase of deployment, and which we'll talk about here in a little bit.
You've talked a little bit about how we start to think about tools that are out there. I know as a unit movement officer, the lieutenant, I planned rotations into the CTCs and then was fortunate enough to deploy into Bosnia as a unit movement officer. Later on in my career, deployed to numerous CTC rotations, overseas deployments, and then a couple of deployments into Iraq. How should commanders look at training their personnel to meet their deployment requirements? What things can they do to make sure that they are ready and are capable of executing those when it comes time to implement their plans?
Well, first off, I'll hit something that I will hit repeatedly throughout the podcast. Pretty much everybody in a unit, regardless of type, request access to the deployer's toolbox. Talk about UMOs. There's literally a UMO tab that will lay out all the requirements, the checklist, kind of what training you need. We've got examples of the orders, pointing UMOs. You know, there's a wealth of tools on the deployer's toolbox that you just have to request access to. There are tools for everybody from that junior NCO or young lieutenant who is a UMO, all the way up to core level checklists for the movement planners at core. So there's something for everybody in there, and that is live. So if you want the latest checklist, the deployer's toolbox. You know, deployment is a very relational thing. So one of the key things that a commander and senior leaders in a unit can do is get to know the folks at all the nodes. I mean, it's a whole lot easier to, you know, call Steve or Mary down at the ITO than to just cold call the ITO and say, hey, we're deploying, what can you do for us kind of thing. So, you know, request access and get to know the tools that are out there.
One area that I think units, at, especially down at the company level, battalion and company level, can look at doing is use every opportunity as a deployment training opportunity. What I mean by that is, as a unit is going to a range or going to an FTX or going to some other event, you know, as the unit is preparing in their motor pool, they can treat that as a deployment and go through the rehearsal steps and so forth. And we have to think differently on how we are using our time, especially, and then starts building those reps and sets for these units, you know, get people getting familiar. Because it's really about repetition, checking, you know, checking tasks and make sure soldiers are proficient in their collective and individual tasks that support metal. So again, you know, money is tight, time is especially tight, but you can definitely incorporate some deployment tasks into everyday training opportunities.
Let me give you just a simple practical tip that I used when I was a commander way, way back when I had more hair and less belly, to just make sure that you were, you know, data was as accurate as you could get it and you were preparing as just part of your normal day-to-day thing. You know, anytime that my supply NCO made changes to my property book, my UMO with the deployment book was sitting right there beside them, so that, you know, if we're changing the configuration of a piece of equipment or adding or subtracting, that UMO was doing what the UMO needed to do to make sure we had, it was in the right configuration, we had the right shackles. And that was literally internal to the unit, putting two NCOs or a lieutenant and NCO together, and that increased the overall readiness.
You mentioned some of the installation support that is available to units. Beyond the ITO, what are the facilities on an installation that are going to help a unit execute their deployment?
Jumping forward to the roles and responsibilities, some of this is installation specific. And of course, there are unique challenges to Compos 2 and 3, the way they have to mobilize and prepare to deploy. But I'll tell you, so for me, the top four that I picked out for, you know, the really key players. First is your unit mope warrants. They are literally, for the Army, a direct links into, you know, the deployment systems and processes. They have a role in training, you know, the movement personnel and how they do that. And that's true for regardless of unit type. So, you know, we've got a professional mope warrant corps that's what they do. They don't do other things. They do deployment. Second, I would say, you know, each installation, and in fact, reserve centers and, you know, all the state headquarters and the like, if you're going, you know, Compos 2 and 3, every installation, every location has a set of installation deployment enablers. You know, you've got your installation transportation offices, you've got your AFSBs, you've got location-specific people. So in some cases, you know, some installations, the airfield is not on the installation. So you've got a different group of people. You really need to, if you can, you know, look them in the eye. Make sure that you know, like I said, make sure you're talking to Steve or Mary versus just some random person that you show up and you don't have a relationship with. For the planners and commanders, I would tell you, the Division Transportation Office, the DTOs are like linking up with the DTO and making sure that you're tied into the planning as early as you can is critical for making sure that you remitigating, by the way, shortfalls and challenges that are happening in the motor pool or at the key nodes. Seems simple, but it's stuff like, you know, making sure you've linked up with the ITO to have, you know, whoever is training the railhead teams, make sure you've got the right number of people, make sure they are actually trained for that location. That you got to know your own house before you start to move around the world into somebody else's.
Stacy hit it right on the head. It's really understanding your role at Echelon and control the things you can control. And that really comes through understanding the plan, understanding who are those key enablers. And as deployments happen, you know, the reserve component has these teams called the deployment and distribution support teams, DDSTs. Those are sometimes added at a location to help advise a unit with their deployment, but those have to be requested. And those are usually requested by the division or the installation. But those are SMEs, resident SMEs, that work for the port, the seaport commander. But those are valuable resources for units to leverage and assist them with their deployment. Again, it's really, as commanders, you should be enabling your personnel to do their job We understand that the unit movement officer at company level is an additional duty, but it's imperative that commanders empower these individuals to really have the time and resources to perform their job. And I can quickly highlight why that's critically important. Stacy mentioned the movement data. The movement data is a single piece of information that has strategic implications. We like to call it the strategic corporal down at the unit. So he or she who is inputting this movement data, if it's incorrect, it has strategic implications all the way through the deployment process, which impacts asset assignment, whether it's a commercial truck, a rail car, a vessel. It affects how those assets are being allocated and utilized. We have found over time that the movement data is not necessarily precise. And while we can absorb a lot of these mistakes today, we think in a large scale conflict where things are moving at large scale, it's going to be a significant problem. That's why it's important for these individuals who are inputting this movement data have the absolute best training and really the proficiency to do their job. And that comes through reps and sets and all the things we talked about previously, the application of that training.
Are there other common factors that you see as potentially stalling or delaying deployments and that units can mitigate through training and understanding of the process beforehand?
The prioritization of deployment into your daily battle rhythm. You know, that's really embracing deployment as an operation, form of maneuver. Now, I'll talk about it here in a little bit why that's going to be important, especially here in the homeland. It's really embracing those tasks as your number one metal task of deploy. It's really honing your craft at company level, at echelon, those collective and individual tasks that support the deployment metal. Again, it's rehearsal, practice. And I can't stress that enough. You know, units have to capitalize on training opportunities to really build those reps and sets. And it's really, people change, you know, so you're always having to update your rail teams, your airload movement teams, et cetera. You have to keep your soldiers proficient in what's expected of them. A lot of times when we go out and observe units, there's a lot of competing events when it comes to deployment. In other words, there's not a lot of white space on the calendar when it leads up to a deployment. So you got SRP occurring, you got rail load operations, you got convoys trying to move out. So it's about having the right people and a bench big enough to support complete operation. So it takes a lot of deconfliction, and that's why this has to be drip battalion and brigade S3s as an operation. Like Stacy mentioned earlier, it's building those relationships across the installation, you know, really understanding who's who in the zoo and who does what and who can really make decisions at the installation level. They're the SMEs for your location. You need to tie closely in with those folks, or it helps reduce some of the frustration when you're trying to deploy. And again, it comes back to leaders, you know, being engaged. And that comes through training, preparation, and everything you're doing for your deployment. You know, absolutely, the commander sets the tone. Support to the commander gets reported on and gets checked. So if that's the tone being set from the beginning, that is absolutely critical.
Let me jump in and add to that. So the Command Deployment Discipline Program is the key tool for the commander to prepare for deployment, but that's actually part of a triad. DDP helps you prepare to deploy as a commander. The Deployment Readiness Exercise Program gives the commander a tool to test that. And that, when you're talking training, you know, you should be going through CDP and doing the inspections and doing the checks and getting everything right, and then at least once a quarter, a couple times a year, test it out. You know, you can do a DREE 1, you can coordinate with your high-level command, do a DREE 2, literally as part of the normal training cycle. Use CDP, prepare, use the DREE to see where you've got issues, go back to the CDP and adjust. So back and forth. And then once you actually have a successful deployment, if you think you've knocked out of the park, you know, the Deployment Excellence Award is the program to recognize units for knocking out of the park. But if you aren't using all three of these in conjunction, then you're just hampering yourself. You know, the very things that will help you mitigate the risk to stumbling during your deployment, if you're not using them, then to be honest with you, you get what you get. And the last thing I'd say, most common factor, and we see it over and over as we engage with units and go out and, you know, inspect units, sloppy paperwork. All it takes is one column mixed up on a hazmat form, And instead of your equipment getting on a boat or a ship at the port, it's going to be frustrated. You know, if you show up, you know, at a node on installation, and you can't explain the difference between regular configuration and travel configuration, and all the paperwork that goes behind that, the labels and the like, then you're just setting yourself up for failure. So, you know, part of that practicing the sets and reps is making sure you tighten up your paperwork, because that's how we input all of the data in the system. That's how we get efficiency out of the system and on the ground.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about the differences for Comp 2 units, Army National Guard, and Comp 3 units, Reserve. I think one of the challenges that they probably have that you guys help them with are that they are deploying not from installations, but maybe from an armory at an area. Can you talk about some of the things that our Comp 2 and Comp 3 units can do to help get them ready, and then how they need to partner with their states or other industry in order to be able to support deployments from their end?
That's the key word in there, partner. Because of the uniqueness of the Guard and Reserve and the challenges they have with being on Title 32, and that's a different pot of money versus Title 10, you know, kind of the handshake between Title 32 and Title 10, the vast majority of units are going to come to either a power projection platform or MFGI, Mobilization Force Generation installation. If they haven't worked the sync of that process and how that should work and have done all the things that they can do as part of pre-deployment activities while they're still on Title 32, really, it's going to be ugly. We see some very ugly transitions from mobilization to deployment, even on our power projection platforms. The uniqueness of how Guard and the Reserve stores their equipment and actually draws their equipment covers some challenges that are truly unique to them. For example, you could have a National Guard or Reserve unit who is actually, the people are coming to PPP or an MFGI, but their equipment is going from some concentration site straight to the port. So you get issues with, you know, making sure you've got the right training equipment sets, making sure that you've, as a unit, as a commander, have gone through and identified what is in that equipment concentration site that you need to bring with you. Because there is some stuff that, you know, you need to update, some stuff you need to get the right, whatever crypto fed into it. So really, it's taking it seriously. I mean, taking deployment seriously and making it part of just the normal battle rhythm events, that applies to all three compos. It just becomes more challenging for compos 2 and 3 because of everything from they aren't on a 3-year, they're on a 5-year rearm cycle, how they access the equipment, limited time, obviously. Commander's going to prioritize what the commander's going to get graded on. So for your assemblies, drill assemblies, if paperwork says I need to be doing life insurance paperwork versus training UMOs, then, I mean, what's the commander going to do? He or she, obviously, is going to focus on the priority.
Excellent. So we've talked about how we prepare to do some of these activities in a home station, non-threatening environment. As you look at the possibility of going into some sort of a large-scale combat operation where it's going to be contested potentially all the way back to the home station as we try to do the RSOI process, can you talk about security measures that units need to consider and implement when preparing to do deployments, particularly if they are going to be going outside the continental United States?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this is a key focus for the whole Army Force Projection Enterprise. So we've been looking at this problem set for quite some time now. And I will tell you, one of the common themes that we are hearing is units must have the mindset that the homeland is no longer a sanctuary when it comes to deployment. And what does that mean? So what it means is as a unit is moving its equipment or personnel to a port of debarkation, you know, you have to think that it's going to be contested, not necessarily kinetically, but it's going to be challenged or contested from the start, right? And that can be everything from as operations are being conducted on an installation through movement to the port of debarkation and all the way through the process. So they have to really understand really the risk and the force protection measures that they need to apply. And so how would a unit do that or understand that? Well, they need to tie into their force protection cells, whether it's at the division or the installation, and understand those critical vulnerabilities that are for their location. And then really, it's about, it may sound cliche, but it's really practice great OPSEC. Previously, ForceCom, during their EDRI programs, one of the tests or the critical areas they would test as a unit is doing an emergency deployment readiness exercise is social media and email phishing attempts. So what they'll do is send out through their cyber teams email phishing attempts to a unit and see how many soldiers reply to that. Talk to us about deployment, and you'd be amazed on how many soldiers are willing to talk about their upcoming deployment. So that's one critical aspect, right? So the enemy is always listening, always watching. And through our social media platforms and our email platforms, I'll tell you we're absolutely vulnerable there. So I can't stress enough, practice really, really good OPSEC. Commanders must understand those critical infrastructure vulnerabilities, their location. And then really, if they're doing those convoy operations, if they're asked to convoy to a port of debarkation, they have to understand how to mitigate the risk to mission and risk to force. And that really requires being tied into the protection branch assessments. And feeding into that is local, state, federal partners to help secure that route along the way. So all routes to the port of debarkation will be approved by the state at the Joint Force Headquarters level. It's going to take all a government approach, really, to make that successful, being tied into those plans.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about the things they need to consider at home station when we're going into contested environments. What are the things they need to consider during the deployment and then arrival in the theater that they have to adjust in order to make sure that they remain safe and able to execute their mission effectively?
Sure, absolutely. As the unit deploys, whether it's usually by airlift, you know, the personnel, their cargo will go by sea move. At the port of debarkation there, they'll start falling into the battle plans of the combat commander, usually ASCC, the Army Service Component Command. So it's all going through RSOI. So as you get into, it's a combat operation at this point, so they fall into the measures prescribed by the ASCC, and that's part of the assembly process, putting themselves back together, uncoiling at the port of debarkation. What we'll probably end up seeing, especially in a large-scale fight, is units will take control of their cargo at the port of debarkation and prepare for onward moves. So that's purely a combat operation at this point. Again, going back to OEF, you know, we're not going to probably have the Kuwait, if everybody's familiar with the way we built up in Kuwait and so forth. It's going to be contested the moment the ramp drops at the port of debarkation, so it's going to be purely a combat operation in a large-scale conflict.
The Army is going through a number of transitions right now, particularly at the senior command levels, as we reorganize some of the commands and the way they interact. What are some changes that you anticipate seeing in the deployment process coming up in the future? And how are you working to address those changes in enabling units to be able to deploy effectively?
A couple things. Thinking through that, so the deployment process itself, you know, the key steps, the pre-deployment activity, planning and activities, the movement, exception staging over movement, that process, the core process really hasn't changed World War II. What we've changed is we've added tools to it, different environments require different sets of tools or different ways to plan. And of course now you look at the fight in Ukraine right now, for us, just add the deployment piece to that. You know, that flexibility, fighting on their home turf. Now think about us having to get into that fight. And we as Army planners spend a lot of time thinking about how we're gonna fight on the battlefield. But if you go back and just look at, you know, the warfighters, the tabletop exercise, the TTXs, the exercises, even the simulations, what you're going to see is we give very little time to what deployment is going to look like, anticipating what those requirements are, theater-specific, unit-specific. So I think what's going to change, and actually I can tell you what is already changing, is recognition of that. We're seeing some just incredible innovation coming out of especially our junior leaders, our NCOs and mob warrants and young officers that are planning this thing and executing on it. They're bringing innovation to the fight that fun to watch. I'm not in uniform anymore, but getting to see these young leaders just step up and knock it out of the park. The change is we're going to have to even increase that. Right now, even though we're adding stuff, bolting on, you know, AI and human machine interface and all that, but really the core of what has got to change and to increase the speed, the flexibility, is really just the capturing that innovation that's coming out of those young leaders who are out executing it. You know, we as the institutional force, we've got to somehow tie in better to all the innovation so we can get it back into, you know, what we're writing and how we're developing units and the like. And then the tools and resources, my goodness, where do you start? You know, increased access to AI with limitations, obviously. We've had some challenges on the Army side of the house, DOD side of the house, making sure that we've got the right output from the AI tool. But tying all the information systems together, you know, we've got some stuff coming as we update the deployer's toolbox, as we're using, you know, Vantage and the like. We have the SEIA tool.
Sustainment, estimation, and dashboard tools.
It's a tool that's available on the CASCOM website. If you go to the CASCOM main page, you'll actually see a link to it. What they've done is they're using tools like Vantage to build in for supply, maintenance, deployment, and the like, various modules that you can download. So if you want something to track like maintenance status, or if you want to track, you know, pre-deployment planning, chances are there is a module that you can go in, you can actually pull that module over, it'll populate your data once you get it set up.
Yeah.
And then you can actually use it without having to go through a whole process of creating something new or doing it on something that is basically static, like Excel or PowerPoint or the like. I think as far as the physical piece of it, it's going to look pretty much the same. However, how we're enabling and how we're planning and how we're flexing, I think that's where you're going to see you're already seeing it, the most change in the process itself. James?
Like we talked earlier, as our data analytics, as our understanding of the information flow of deployment improves, not only does it allow us to see ourselves and see where the friction and the challenges are, but it speeds up the process. So going forward in a future conflict, it's absolutely critical to use our finite resources correctly and precisely. That finite resources are our rail cars in the homeland. You know, there's a limited number of those rail cars available across the force. So it's absolutely critical that our data are accurate so we can precisely put those assets where they're most needed on time. You know, as we build combat power, look at the combat commander, it's going to be critical that our information learning and our data requirements are keeping speed at the point of need to meet those requirements.
You both talked a little bit about the opportunities for soldiers to see challenges and get feedback and innovation. Is there a specific way you would like folks, when it comes to the deployment process, to get information back to CASCOM about the things that they're learning?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's an exciting time as the Army transforms within the Combined Arms Command. Is the TLIMS. Those are the lessons learned forums that are being stood up. Those will be absolutely a critical inject point at every center of excellence to get the feedback real time. We're developing collection plans for these TLIMs now as they go out and assess units and look at those are critical data points that will feed back into the enterprise here to make .mil PF changes across to really improve the deployment process.
Before we conclude, do you have any additional observations or final thoughts you'd like to share with our audience regarding deployment planning and execution?
Sure, I'll kick that off. I'll give you two. But really, if you're a commander or a young leader or a UMO, whatever, familiarize yourself with the tools that are available. CADP, the Deployer's Toolbox, there's a host of tools that are out there. There is a feature on the Deployer's Toolbox in a blog where you can ask questions, but that's also a way that if you've got some product or tool or something that you think is just fantastic and it would help the Army, send that to us. You know, we'll vet it and we'll get it out there so, you know, it's available for everybody. And then the last point I would make, what the commander deems is important becomes the focus. You know, absent commanders equals lax preparation. But engaged commanders is where you get, at the unit level, increased accuracy, efficiency, effectiveness. You know, what matters to the commander matters to the unit.
Yeah, and just to conclude on this topic, is deployment training. Bake that into your everyday operations, whether it's going to a range or going to an FTX. That is absolutely critical, and it builds the muscle memory and familiarity at the company level, especially what it takes to deploy. And I will tell you why that's important. So what we'll see on a lot of our visits is units will take shortcuts when it comes to deploying to a CTC rotation. And what I mean by that is they'll skip some steps in the process. So when it comes time to a rotational deployment, they don't really truly appreciate the time it takes to do those steps that they miss. So again, don't skip steps, force the standard, and really take that to heart and really bake that into your training plan.
Mr. Lee and Mr. Swenson, thank you for joining us and sharing your insights. Today we discuss lessons for units conducting deployment operations. You can find call resources available by going to www.army.mil/call, our CAC-enabled site. There you may download products or request print products shipped to you. For more insights into topics discussed, see CALL's Deployment Handbook, Leader's Guide to Command Maintenance, and First 100 Days XOS3. If you have trouble finding information on our website, use our Request for Information tab and receive direct feedback from an analyst at CALL. Finally, if you have a best practice to submit or a capability gap that requires a .MILPF solution, submit observations directly to CALL using the Quickfire portal on our website. Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media. I would like to thank all our CALL team members, including the author of the Deployment Handbook, Mr. Kirk Foster, and our show's producer, Ms. Paige Cox, for their help in executing this podcast. Thank you for listening to CALL's podcast, Insights from the Fight. We are dedicated to providing you with the insights you need to lead, train, and fight today and in the future. Join us next time for another discussion on lessons learned from the force.